Darth Vader comes out, and everybody who was so serious working, all the equipment went dropped to the ground. Everybody was just sort of, it was, they played the music, you know, he entered on set with the music crazy. And like everybody turned into a teenager, you know, it was just amazing.
I literally just got chills right now. Welcome to the Art of Costume Blogcast. I'm Spencer Williams.
And I'm Elizabeth Joy Glass. How's it going?
Hello, Elizabeth. Oh my gosh. Thank you for joining me on the wonderful planet of Tatooine.
Absolutely.
Where everything here is perfectly fine.
Everything's great. There's sand and it's fine.
There's raiders that want to kill you. Inquisitors keep showing up, chopping her hands off, looking for some dusty guy who supposedly died 10 years ago, but you know,
Anakin was right. The sand is bad.
So we are here to talk about a fun TV series as part of our Star Wars month. It's been packed this Star Wars month.
Absolutely. We are here to talk about Obi-Wan Kenobi, the TV show. I gotta say, I really liked this one.
It's so good.
It was just like charming. It like warmed like my heart. Like it gave me so many like warm fuzzies and like memories from watching the trilogy, the prequels as a child. I was like, where you go, Ewan McGregor? Look who you go.
Yeah, no, it really gave me all the feels. You know, you and I feel like, well, at least I'll speak for me. I grew up on the prequels. Of course, I watched, you know, the classic trilogy. But the prequel films are really what was coming out as I was kind of growing up. And that was what I, you know, fell in love with and what brought me into the Star Wars universe. So this series really just gave me all the feels.
Yeah.
Seeing Hayden Christensen come back.
Oh, man. What a throwback.
Come on, man. He is just so cool. And yes. I just feel like this is his moment. And I'm just so happy for him. And I'm happy for us that we got to stick around and see this come together. You know?
Yeah, it's so cool. You saying like, oh, you grew up with the trilogy. Like, I remember I definitely saw like the original three first. But that's because my parents chose like, showed us like strange movies at a very young age, because I was like, wow, I was probably a toddler when I watched the original trilogy, because I remember watching the prequels and like knowing what everything was about. And
yeah,
like the first, and it came out in like 1999, and I was like four or five.
I remember seeing it in the theaters, pretending I was like pod racing. Oh my gosh, at Chuck E. Cheese they had the pod racing ride. Do you remember that?
No, like, I didn't get to go to Chuck E. Cheese very often.
Oh my gosh. I mean, I should have saw this coming, but anyways.
What does that mean?
We have a great guest. I'm so excited to talk to her about her work on this series. But first, we have to get to our everyday business. Elizabeth, why don't you hit us with a summary?
Absolutely. We have Obi-Wan Kenobi, the former Jedi Master that we all know and love, as he contends with the consequences of his greatest defeat and the downfall of the Jedi Order and his one-time friend and apprentice, Anakin Skywalker, who has turned to the dark side as the evil Sith Lord, Darth Vader.
Ooh, major bummer.
Yeah. That's the whole story arc for Vader, though. Major bummer.
Yeah, literally bummered down. Let's dive behind the wardrobe. We have director Deborah Chow and costume designer Sutarat and Larlarb.
Yes.
You will know Sutarat from her work on Slumdog Millionaire, for which she won a Costume Designer Guild Award. Sunshine, which Elizabeth just gave me a full recounting before we got on the air. Sounds very exciting.
I did.
Don't start the sun, everyone. 127 Hours, Frankenstein, American Gods, the TV series, Gemini Man, and No Time to Die, the James Bond film for which she was nominated for another Costume Designer Guild Award. And with that, we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we will be joined by the costume designer herself, Sutarat and Larlarb.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I am so pleased to welcome costume designer Sutarat and Larlarb. Hey Sutarat, how are you?
Welcome.
I am great, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
We're so excited to have you on. We've been talking about your work so much, and it's just a real pleasure for you to be a part of our Star Wars month. It wouldn't be complete without you.
Thank you.
Well, I want to start from the beginning. What's so exciting about this project in particular, as I'm sure you could attest to, is the culmination of the legacy that is the Star Wars universe. We see the classic trilogy for which John Mollo famously designed the costumes on a small budget, meet the stories and characters of the prequel trilogy, which Elizabeth and I kind of grew up with costumes designed by Trisha Biggar. What did your preparation and research look like on this project now that we're kind of merging those two worlds together?
Well, interestingly, I know you've put together this trio of images, but you could have come and work in my department because this is exactly the kind of thing. Obviously, you wouldn't have had the third image yet in the design process, but this is exactly the kind of thing I would do. I would, you know, when you take on something like this with such a iconic legacy sort of almost cultural importance to it, you can't ignore what came before you. And you have to, especially in this story where you're actually talking about one character who's developed over time, backwards, forwards, all of that. So there was a sort of special remit with this project, which is we're inserting Obi-Wan into a timeline that is very well established already, sort of before and an after. So, very definitely research is like the DNA of the project. You have to go back, you have to look at what the language, the visual language was. And in the world of Star Wars, of course, you and any Star Wars fans will know and recognize that Star Wars is really, really specific in the world of sci-fi. It's so, you know, arguably it's the most grounded in a way. Like you're in right. These cultures and everybody's costumes, everybody's looks, the environments, the props, all of them are derived from where they live and what the action requires in the environment that they exist in. So these costumes, even though there's other influences, obviously, with samurai culture and all of the things that would have been, you know, enter the equation in the original one, the 70s versions with George Lucas and John Mollo, I wanted to make sure I understood all of that. So when we had our version of it, it felt natural to that development, you know, both kind of inherently in the language of it, visually, you want to have some relationship to it just because Star Wars is one of those things that's sort of bigger than itself. Like you can't kind of go too off-piste without alienating a whole bunch of people who have lived, you know, all of that is so well digested in a fan's memory of what came before. And so you have to pay a lot of homage to that, I think. At the same time, you're showing a new chapter. And so you have to be able to push things forward, but still respect what came before. And if you're going to make decisions that feel separate, I feel like you really have to have a good reason. Interestingly, in this trio of images, you've done this great job of kind of seeing, you see the parallels, you see the relationship between the development of the cost of between each of these photos and the development of Obi-Wan at various periods of his life. And funnily enough, you know, you have this iconic image of the kind of brown and oatmeal colored robe, the jar. And when I did the breakdown of what Tatooine residents were like, if you actually kind of go in with a sort of forensic eye, I was taking screen grabs of every single patron in the canteen. I was taking screen grabs of everybody who walked by, any of the vehicles, any of the people on the street, the background, the, you know, the atmosphere. I took screen grabs of every kind of clothing item I could see. And when I put that on a board, you see not just Jedi versions of it, but there is a Tatooine look that is very attached to what we've come to understand as a Jedi look. When you break that down even further, it's the environment. Like, it's a very, it's an environment in which the dyes that would have come from the plants on Tatooine or the pigments from the minerals of the sand and the earth would have colored these clothing. So you have this one thread, which is very steeped in sort of Jedi lore. And then you have this other thread, which is very Tatooine-y. And with our Obi-Wan sort of being quote unquote hidden in plain sight in Tatooine, we had this great opportunity to still make him feel like Obi-Wan for a fan, but also make him feel like Tatooine resident, you know, incognito-ish, because he's living in Tatooine and can't be recognized by any of the Tatooine citizens as being Obi-Wan. The first look you see him in, he's in a blue, kind of an indigo, woady blue linen tunic shirt that is makes him fit into the environment he's working in. And so that's I wanted to make sure that when we met him, we, as both the audience and also if you were living in Tatooine, you'd understand that this is someone who just fits within this whole scheme of things, and he's not yet the Obi-Wan we'll come to understand he is later in the series.
Right. You almost couldn't recognize him at first.
Yeah. And that was sort of the point. And there was a lot of ruminating over this, because, you know, with a franchise like this, there's this responsibility to introduce, especially a character like Obi-Wan, who's, I would say, in the top echelon of memorable characters and definitive characters. You want him to be recognized, obviously, by an audience coming into it who knows the history of Obi-Wan. But you also want it to make sense for the story, which is he's in hiding in plain sight, you know, and he's not wearing it's not a disguise. He has to fit into Tatooine. But luckily, there were these bridges between what he would end up wearing and what a Tatooine citizen every day might be wearing that gave us, you know, the right amount of being able to touch on both of those things.
Right. So exciting.
Also, probably the most exciting character of the whole series, we have Princess Leia. Her costumes really channeled like the spirit of Carrie Fisher's original Leia that we all come to have known and love. The silhouettes and colors, it just like, it all really worked and was so gorgeous. How did you approach her design?
Well, interestingly too, this is obviously another definitive iconic character who lots of people are going to have an opinion about and an expectation for. And then you think, okay, as the responsibility of the costume designer, yes, is to make a character exciting for someone to visually consume and remember. But you also have this other responsibility. We were trying to tell a very specific story. Where did she come from? And how does she end up being the Carrie Fisher version? What are the roots that you might see in our version that then would develop into the version that we all already knew and loved? And so the sort of, I think, knee-jerk, instinctive visual for Princess Leia in the Carrie Fisher version is the white ensemble, right? Or the cream ensemble, depending on your calibration of your screen. You know, I think knowing that was sort of like the apex Princess Leia, you have to then think, okay, how does she get there? And we have obviously the story of she's in Alderaan and we meet her and there's this event happening in her, in the palace in which she's grown up. And we really, I loved this idea that was evident in the script, that it's in her character. She's substituted herself with one of her minions, right? And that person is wearing the official royal garment that she's supposed to be wearing to this banquet. And you don't find that it's a trick in the beginning. And where she really is, it's outside playing in the trees like any kid would, observing from, like, not really wanting to be in the itchy wool clothing, not wanting to be like put in front of a bunch of adults. She just wants to play and have adventures, right? And she's a kid. So we want to make sure that we're telegraphing the kid-like part of that, like the irreverence and the willfulness. And she's a kid who has also quite a lot of power. So she's got the stubbornness of knowing herself. And so even if a parent or an official dresser or anybody in the royal household would be like, no, these are the clothes that your mom and you, we fit them for you, they've been made for you for this occasion. She from the beginning, she's already like broken the rules, right? She's out there, she's doing her thing up in the tree, and she's ignoring like the convention of what's been set out for that day. Anyway, she comes back, she's dragged into the banquet situation. She has to don those garments. There's a few Easter eggs in this garment, which I'm sure people have tried to break apart, but I'll just explain them in case it's not evident.
Please do.
Yeah, the symbol on her, the embroidered in the sort of magenta ombre, we called it the pinafore. The embroidery on that is actually the symbol on her chest, and then the ones that kind of go in the arc in the next layer above that. That is an amalgamation. I asked when I saw that we were going to have this banquet, I thought to myself of queens and royalty who in their cultures, in real life, in planet Earth, in our lifetime, queens who are so connected to their people and the culture and the handicrafts of the world that they come from, that they actually encourage the weaving and the textiles of their country, their world, to enter into the patterns that they wear when they go to royal occasions. And I wrote to Pablo, the Star Wars historian, and I asked him, what is the flora and fauna on Alderaan that's been established so far that might be recognizable or even not, but what were the original discussions of what the environment would be? Wow. Because I feel like that's a common thing in weaving, is you take the official flora fauna that's everywhere, that everybody on that planet or that country would know, and you make it a motif that people there would understand and integrate it into a textile. So it's a combination of, I believe it's called the Struggling Pearl Blossom, which was established in a manga version of in the Star Wars universe of all the things that happen in the world related officially. Wow. it's the love child between the Struggling Pearl Blossom fictional flower, which has a little pearl in the inside, which I'm going to come back to. Remind me to come back to the pearl because it relates to the Queen Brea in this. He said that the environment, if it was a real world environment, it would be like an Edelweiss or an alpine flower, which the name is escaping me. So I took those flowers and I kind of amalgamated them and made it her royal symbol. Her mother, the queen, or her adopted mother, the queen, has that same motif printed on the inside of the cape of her dress. And inside each, like the middle of each flower, is a pearl that's been stitched on. Wow. I'm not sure if that's, you can see that in the, you know, in the series, but if you got up close to the costume, like that's the kind of detail we were trying to run through as a sort of celebration of Alderaan.
That's beautiful. I love the attention to detail, especially since Alderaan really doesn't get its time and place so much in the universe. So this is really the first time we get to explore it.
And so with that, you can then start there with all the bells and whistles of Alderaan and royalty, and then break away from that as she goes on there. And as she goes on her adventure, she's making more and more of her own choices. She's drawn to the yellow gloves in the marketplace. She, you know, the poncho rain cape idea sort of harkens to something we're going to see on Carrie Fisher in a later rendition. And then the layers kind of peel away. And finally, when you're in the last episode, you see a little mini version of what you might see later with Carrie Fisher. And it's also got the same embroidery on it.
It's so beautiful. I love it so much. It just, the colors, the silhouettes, it really just felt like this was, like you said, planting the roots for what we will later come to know, that what we grew up with. It's so cool. What I also was obsessed with as a serious Star Wars nerd was seeing the Inquisitors come to life in live action. Particularly, I love Reva and the Grand Inquisitor. The pieces are so technical. I love the lines and the silhouettes and the textiles are so interesting. I have to imagine working on these characters in particular were a lot of fun, but probably a challenge, I'm assuming.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about doing anything of this nature is, yes, you have to, the Inquisitors, except for Reva, are well established, right? So you already kind of have to, you're basically bring to life something that was only ever conceived in a sort of literal 2D form. But when you take something that's established in a 2D form and you bring it to life in 3D, and the characters are written with quite a lot of action, mobility becomes an issue. So you start having to, which is why, like in earlier days, I'm not just talking about Star Wars, but you know, in earlier generations of filmmaking where you have armor, anything that relates to armor, and you have to move in that armor, there's a sort of stiffness to how people move and walk. And that is sort of legit because these are hard pieces on a, let's say, soft body, and the body is trying to do things that the hardness is trying to contain, you know?
Yeah.
So we actually spent a lot of time kind of engineering a sort of preordained Inquisitor look for the ones that you already know, and worked on them so that they worked on these particular actors' bodies, and they were able to move and express themselves in the way that would be natural to them for their characters. Reva is a new addition to this lexicon. There was probably the liberty of being able to, and knowing, obviously, when I come into something, it's like I know what her journey is going to be. So anticipating the amount of movement and her particular relationship to the other characters, was able to sort of channel all that, discussions with Deb, our director, with Doug Chang, looking at the history of anybody that's on that side of the gamut of Star Wars, like, off, you know, Imperial officers, anything where I could take the lines that already exist and kind of recalibrate them for this new character who then kind of, she fits with the Inquisitors, but she's got her own will. So she's sort of the least, I would say, flashy of them. She's sort of more serious, and in terms of her, you know, she kind of has this naturalness to her that I think the other ones are, you know, covered in the symbols of being who they are. She is more about the form following the function of what she needs to do. So her armor is developed in a way that sort of helps, you know, not get in the way of all the physicality that she's going to be employing. Her cape is split in the back for mobility. There's the, I used kind of historical armor reference to kind of see where all the joints would make sense, but also needing to pay attention to where the other Inquisitors were with their armor, paring it down a little bit. There's this cool detail, which depending on the line, you kind of see it in this picture. She has a, I remember Moses came up with a great nickname for this detail, and we called it the spine. And it's basically like a sharp spine that's running down the center front of her, of that leather bodice. Ooh. It's all leather. Her armor is molded leather.
Wow.
So I could go on forever about every single detail. It's a lot.
I remember seeing this though, telling Elizabeth, I was like, this is probably my favorite Star Wars armor I've ever seen. If I were to pick my armor, it would be this one. I probably want Rocket as well, but you know, it's badass.
Yeah, thank you. And I wanted to make sure because, you know, I feel like armor, not just in Star Wars, but when armor is done for women, mm-hmm. there ends up being this femaleness to the it a lot of the time, not all the time. But how do you resolve that? How do you give her that sort of the power, the gender-free power of just power without gender attached to it?
Right.
But deal with the fact that she has a body that is biologically constructed in a way that armor doesn't necessarily, armor historically wasn't developed for that shape, mm-hmm. you know, like the anatomy of a woman is not friendly to how armor is supposed to be.
Yeah.
So this was a great, I feel like we got, you know, taking from all those, from that palette of information and his Star Wars history and historical history, we came up with this, which I too feel very, very close to this armor. It was one of the first things that I designed.
Yeah. Oh, that's so cool. Yeah, well, definitely shows. I love that set of armor. So this series sees the return of Darth Vader. And I looked up the stat right before. What I think is so fascinating about Darth Vader is that the total amount of screen time we see Darth Vader in George Lucas's Star Wars is only 36 minutes, which was shocking to me. So come to Obi-Wan, it's kind of exciting because we really don't see this armor as much as we think we do. It's just so embedded in our heads.
Yeah.
So it really adds to the mystery and the horror of Darth Vader. So I don't get to ask this too often, but what was it like working with Darth Vader?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's, so when you get a job like this and you have this responsibility, even though, like, with some distance, I can kind of nerd out about it, like, go, oh my God,
like scream into a pillow.
Yeah. But when you've, you know, but the sort of the terror of reality sets in with all the stakes and the responsibilities. And so I kind of couldn't go there yet. I had to, like, respect the fact that it was bigger than me and respect the challenge that lay beneath it and respect the fact that I couldn't get cocky about it. I couldn't, mm-hmm. you know, like, it's too, one of those moments in cinema history, looks in cinema history, that's like any change you're going to make. And I say the change with the biggest level of respect you can imagine. We had to, let's say, augment some things, change some things that were hopefully imperceptible. I mean, there's obviously people who are going to look at it and know exactly what we did, but anything we did like that, there's an absolute necessity to it. For one, when you design a thing like this for another body, another head, another face, there are things that have to fit that person. Otherwise it's going to look, it has to fit. That person is still performing something. They need to embody this whole thing. It cannot feel like a Halloween costume, right? Mm-hmm. So there were changes that we had to make to the armor that are imperceptible in the sense that we've paid so much attention to making sure that you don't see the change or you don't read it as much as, like, oh, let's just make it blue. It's not that kind of change. It's sort of engineering changes, right? We have different materials at our disposal in 2020 and 2021 than they did in the 70s. So we could make things lighter and more flexible, but still read as hard and armor-like and pay attention to what Malo's version was. We knew this Vader was going to be more active, more physical, and a lot of the original costume and ensuing costumes, as technology is helping the costume industry, we could get more mobility for our performer that is not natural to the shapes that are present in this costume. The mask, and I need to kind of big up the relationship I had with FBFX in London, who kind of created all the pieces for us this go round and really helped re-engineer some of the inner workings and how things went together, how they stayed on the body. Our Darth Vader lifts his arms. In previous versions of the costumes, if you lift your arm, the whole top of the armor shifts up and the arm is still down here. You know, wow. You've got to make it so that it feels like it's part of his body. So there were things that we had to, I won't go on too much about the engineering, but the same thing goes for the helmet. You know, there's more dialogue because he's fighting so much. He has to have better vision, all these things. The shape of, you know, Hayden's head in the helmet is different from original performers in that helmet. So tweaking some proportionality so that you still get the Vader and knowing that he's actually a younger Vader at this point, right? So there is an argument to be said that over the character's aging process, that some of that armor would change the way that human bodies change and you start wearing different clothes when you get older. You know, I don't want to cheapen it like that, but that's part of the justification for needing to adapt things because a body changes over time, right? So, but hopefully I will just quickly wrap the Darth Vader discussion up with, you asked about, were you excited screaming into a pillow? Well, because I had to actually, me and my amazing team in LA and also our amazing team in London that was manufacturing the pieces and putting it together, and we were doing all these remote things, we were all so weighted by the responsibility that we couldn't get that excited. But there were a few moments where we all turned back into our teenage selves, which was the first fitting with Hayden, putting it on.
Wow.
The second time was when my starting on Obi-Wan was 18 months out from shooting.
Wow.
So this was the first thing we worked on because we knew about the physicality and how long it was going to take to calibrate everything. So 18 months later, he walks on set after all the work that's been going every day, hours and hours of work on both sides of the globe, shows up on set. And the 200 people working on the set who hadn't been in that process, Darth Vader comes out and everybody who was so serious working, all the equipment went dropped to the ground. Everybody was just sort of, they played the music, you know, he entered on set with
That's
the music
crazy.
And like everybody turned into a teenager, you know, it was just amazing.
I literally just got chills right now.
Yeah, it was an amazing, and that was probably the moment was like, oh yeah, I got to work on that.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, the humility. Yeah.
It's so exciting just to, like, from a costume design point of view too, like that's what made Darth Vader so cool in this series is you're right. He was able to move his arms, which, you know, to maybe regular people, you think, oh yeah, well, he's moving his arms. But to us, it's like, he's moving. He's able to get at you now because his costume is allowing him to.
Yeah.
And that's just such a cool concept. And yeah, just appreciate you. That's so cool.
Thank you.
Another really cool scene was this flashback with Obi-Wan and Anakin. I was so impressed by it. I love the costumes. And because I was like, I felt like it was ripped right from the, you know, the prequel series. And I was like, well, I assume these weren't just like hanging around from 2005. So
No. I mean, I had the great privilege of getting to go to the Lucasfilm archives and study the costumes. There's a wonderful archivist there, Lena, who showed me everything, the original costumes. I mean, even from the 70s. So I spent quite a lot of time up there looking and taking photos. And then when we knew what the scene was going to be and what parts we were going to need to match, we couldn't take the clothes with us. A lot of costume projects, you get to borrow the original thing and copy it. You know, you have your tailors kind of do precise measurements. You can hold the fabrics up, do tests with dye, really just get up there and do an exact match, like a replica match. But in this version, we couldn't take the costumes. They're so precious and rightfully so. You don't want them leaving the building. I mean, what am I going to do? Carry them on my carry-on bag? You're not going to check them in your bags, right? Like,
I mean, we could try, but
No. You know, they need to be respected. It'll be like taking, you know, like the Dead Sea Scrolls into your backpack, you know? So I had a good relationship with Alina up the archives. And when we looked at our pictures, had an amazing buyer on the team, Elise, who was so, like, she's also an incredible Star Wars nerd. She was, her, the responsibility on, she was, like, you could see the anxiety when she knew we had to copy this costume. It wasn't like, well, yeah, it's kind of oatmeal and a kind of a loose weave. And yeah, you probably get away with this. No. Like every time she wanted to present me, like, okay, so the sash, I've looked at the pictures that we put these boards together. She like zoomed in closely. She went back and watched the movie. She did a version of what I had already done because she needed to understand for herself. Alina, I would ask her, okay, we're looking at the distance between the end of the sash and the beginning of the seam. And can you do this precise measurement? And I would do a little draw over on my iPad of like, this looks like it might be 4 inches in this picture, but in this picture, it looks like 2 inches. Can you do a measure? So it was like a you know, like an archaeological matching, like you imagine that there's a piece missing from a statue that they found in ancient Rome. And for the museum version, they had to fill that piece in. So like all the science and the minds that go into like filling out in a faithful way, that's what we did for these costumes. Wow. And I'll tell you, the payoff was hearing you just say that right now. But the first payoff was Hayden walking into the room, putting the stuff on, and just seeing the look on his face. Like it was amazing. I have to tell you, it was an amazing moment. Like I felt something else was happening in the room.
Wow. I mean, it's amazing. I feel proud knowing that he had that moment. It just feels like a full circle payoff moment for everyone who, you know, loved the movies, everyone who worked on the movies in the past. It's just an awesome moment. And as a final question, you know, this was such a highly anticipated series. You had an incredible crew. So just asking final thoughts, you know, what did this project mean to you?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I think I'm still processing what it means. You know, like I had never been to a Star Wars celebration. And I went to the Star Wars celebration, which we premiered the first two episodes of this. And I knew intellectually, you know, I grew up with the 70s versions and I was obsessed. And my brother was a huge collector. And for me, probably two things really threw me basically knocked me backwards. One was the response at Star Wars Celebration was just like, it was this palpable, I don't know, the energy of excitement, anticipation, and happiness from seeing these characters come back to life and the way we did. Like it's not a paper reaction, you know, it's not a, like, I don't know. It's just like a religious experience or something. Yeah. You just felt moved. And I was moved by how moved people were. And I was so excited that I was part of that. So I don't think I quite understood before, even though I was excited and I knew what was potentially coming. I still don't think I've been able to digest like what it actually means to have been able to have my hand as part of this incredibly this cultural touchstone, right? The other moment was when I got my first action figures, because as a kid, that was like, we were so obsessed with those action figures. My brother had like the set he played with, and then he had the set that he never took out of the box, and then there was a spare set. And like, if he couldn't find all of them, you know, and then I found recently cleaning out my mom's house, like going through old closets, stashes of stuff she never gave to us. But when I got the first action figure, Reva, the new Obi-Wan, like all that stuff, I was God. Like, so, you know, it just brought back a lot of childhood stuff that was, yeah, I'm not sure that I'm able to actually describe the feeling, but it's pretty cool. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Super cool. Are you able to like check the action figures for accuracies too?
Well, you know, while you're shooting these things, you're actually thinking of, well, you're doing your job, but there's after a scene has been established and there's a little bit of time and the actor's waiting to go to their next change or their next scene, there was a section where you would go and scan the costume. And I was probably there 90% of the time. We were so busy and spread thin, but every time I knew that the scan was going to end up as details on the action figure. So I tried with all my might to be there to kind of make sure like, nothing was folded in weird or like the shoulders were in the right place or, you know, because it's the information that then goes to like all the other people that are going to then interpret your work. And I can't be there to answer those questions. So that the answer has to be kind of right there. And so me and key members of the team, the assistant designer, the supervisor, the people who take care of these characters on set, we were all doing that simultaneously to making the film, the series, excuse me.
Wow.
That's so cool. I didn't know designers did that. Costume designer Sutara and Larlarv, thank you so much for coming. This was awesome. It was so exciting to meet you and we're just so happy for you. Congratulations. Such a great project.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, thank you. Very exciting to talk to you.
The Art of Costume blogcast is hosted and produced by Elizabeth Joy Glass and Spencer Williams. Our audio engineering and editing is done by Dan White. Follow us on Instagram at The Art of Costume Pod or visit theartofcostumeblogcast.com for all blogcast updates. If you want to support the show, go to theartofcostume.com/podstore. For more costume reviews, deep dives, and interviews, head over to theartofcostume.com, a blog dedicated to highlighting the best in costume design.